Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Hey, how old were you when you left home? Well, depending on your age, the answer is probably different depending on the generation you're in. Well, today, a growing number of young adults are dependent on their parents well beyond the college years, often up to age 30. And in my practice, I've seen a dramatic escalation in what social scientists are calling delayed adolescence, which raise questions about how much control can, should parents have over their adult children? What's the child's responsibility, and what should we consider them anyway? Are they adolescents, adults, or somewhere in between? Today's show, we're going to be talking about the route to independence for young adults, and we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests on today's show are Larry Steinberg, Jennifer Lynn Tanner, and Janet Burson. Steinberg is the author of You and Your Adolescent, The Essential Guide for Ages 10 to 25. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at Temple, and he joins me here in the studio. Larry, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Janet Burson is a psychologist practicing in Morristown, New Jersey. She specializes in counseling young adults and families. Janet, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
And Jennifer Lynn Tanner is a visiting research assistant professor at the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Aging Research at Rutgers. She joins us by phone from her home in New Jersey. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Larry, let's start with you. A social scientist recently said that in all previous generations, parents had at least a sense of the world their children were growing up in. And now parents don't. The world has changed so dramatically. So I'm going to ask you a very difficult, if not unreasonable, question. Can you give us a sense of the world today's children are growing up in? Your college student?
Sure. I think it's a more uncertain world. I think on the one hand, that uncertainty has meant that there are lots of exciting and interesting possibilities ahead. On the other hand, the uncertainty makes it more difficult to make a transition into adulthood in an orderly, predictable way. And I think the challenge facing many parents out there is that it's tempting to try to compare your young adult child's development and current situation to what you were doing when you were that age.
Well, it's almost inevitable, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, my parents did it.
Yes, and the gap between your parents and you was not as large as the gap between, right, let's say, people my age, I'm in my late 50s, and our young adult children, because the worlds are that much more different.
Hmm.
And let me just add that the difference has been exacerbated by the temporary decline in the economy that we're facing now. So there are some permanent ways in which things have changed, and I think that there are some temporary ways, let's hope they're temporary, in which they've changed too.
Jennifer, I'd like to hear your take. What's life like for our young people, for this generation? And I don't just mean at this moment in their lives. I mean, what's it like growing up in their lives in the digital age, with the changes in dating and in peer groups and relationships?
I think that growing up in contemporary society for young people, there is a lot more burden on the psychological aspects of self. I think that the old way of becoming adult, there was this pathway into adulthood that, you know, let individuals kind of gain social reward by getting married and making on-time transitions, marriage, becoming a parent. And I think that what the challenge is for young people today is that they need to do a lot more interpersonal and intrapersonal work. There's a high demand for that. And one way that you can see it in their daily lives is that the questions that people asked a generation ago, you know, who am I? What do I want to do in the world? You know, maybe you thought about that in your head. Maybe you talked about it with your friends. Certainly maybe your parents or your partners. But now these young people are doing this online, and they're hooked into media all the time. Their identities and their process of who am I going to be, they're out there for the world to see. So they're getting a lot more information about different options about who they can be and places they can fit into this world. And at the same time, it really makes them do a lot more work.
I have seen a lot of this in my practice, but and I'll turn to you again, Jennifer. Is there any way to know to what extent this is a real phenomenon, or is this just anecdotal?
I agree with Dr. Steinberg in that there's some evidence that some of this is temporary, but a lot of what we see is permanent. We do know that psychosocial development, or the way people are answering questions like "Who am I? Where do I fit in this world?" We know that those have intensified, and as you're saying, that you see it, clinicians see it in private practice. Parents are reporting it. Well, we do also see it empirically that these are some of the issues that young people are saying are very much part of what they're struggling with, and I don't think that that's going to go away, because as the world becomes more complex, as technology integrates and globalizes, these challenges will maybe we'll get better at dealing with them. I mean, that's what I foresee, but I don't think they're going to go away.
What, Larry? What are the fundamental changes? I mean, is physiology changing, or is it just external?
I don't think that physiology is changing in a way that would manifest itself in the kinds of consequences that we've been discussing. So I think it's mainly external. I think as a rule of thumb, the process of identity development is made more difficult and more challenging as a function of the number of different choices and alternatives you have to choose among. So, for example, when young women came of age in, let's say, the 1950s, and there were basically four occupations that they, you know, would choose among if they were going to be employed full-time at all. Well, now there are hundreds and hundreds of occupations for women to choose among, and therefore the process of developing an identity for young women today is very different than it was 50 years ago by virtue of this expansion of alternatives.
Well, and that could be good news or bad news. Peter Weibrow, psychiatrist professor at UCLA, wrote a book called The Tyranny of Choice, and how choice raises anxiety and right, in many respects gives one more options, but also gives one more anxiety too.
And so I think that what you end up seeing is that this then sort of separates the individuals who are able to take advantage of the choices from those who are overcome by anxiety and who end up floundering a lot. And I think that parents often look at their young adult kids and wonder, is mine doing okay? Is this a normal pattern of development?
Yeah, let me want to talk about parenting and resilience, but I want to introduce you, and then I want to play a piece of an interview where our executive producer, Mike and Scott, recently did. We're talking about what's being called delayed adolescence, I guess for lack of a better word, how our children are staying with us sometimes up until age 30. My guests are Larry Steinberg. He's the author of You and Your Adolescent, The Essential Guide for Ages 10 to 25, Jennifer Lynn Tanner. She's a visiting research assistant professor at the Institute for Health and Healthcare Policy at Rutgers. Janet Burson is a psychologist in Morristown, New Jersey. Our number, if you want to call in, we've got a few lines open, are 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. But first, WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott, spoke with Amanda McGrath, a senior at Temple University, and asked her about how she feels about growing up.
Well, before I was really into the idea of growing up. Obviously, most people are. But now that I'm getting to the point where I'm going to graduate, I would very much like to just stay in school for a couple more years, and as many years as possible, actually, and not have to join the real world in the workforce.
Why?
It's just comfortable this way. My parents help me out with whatever I need. I get to spend time focusing on classes that are tailored to my interests, and everything's paid for already. I don't have any money worries.
So what are you worried about when you graduate? What does that look like when you think about it?
Well, I have to find a job, and every job market is hard to break into. And since I'm trying to break into media, Philadelphia is a huge market for that, and it's just such a big place that I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to find even an entry-level position here and that I'll have to move. I might have to go somewhere middle of nowhere, Kansas, to get a job, and that's really scary.
So is it about transitions, really?
I guess so, yeah, because I've been in college for so long at this point. It's gotten to be my way of life. It's how I've gotten used to it. And leaving that and actually becoming an adult is not something that I'm looking forward to.
But do you feel like you already are an adult on some levels?
On some levels, not levels that are important. I don't know how to manage money. I don't know anything about taxes. I don't. Half the time when I get a job, I don't ask how much I make. It just doesn't enter into my mind.
So what would help you in that transition? Because you're going to have to get out there eventually.
I'm really not sure. I think my parents have been good. They've been trying to get me to be more financially independent. So I'm learning to manage money slowly, very slowly. Money is my big thing. I know I don't have enough of a concept of what money is.
So when you go to a school like Temple, I went to Temple, you have people from all different walks of life. So I'm sure there are people in your classes who are your age, who might have children, who might have big responsibilities already. Does that feel like you're younger than them, or how does that feel?
I feel like in some ways I'm less mature than they are, just because they have real jobs, not just work-study jobs like I have. They have actual, like, full-time jobs outside of school. They have to balance their lives in such a crazy way. And I'm just kind of hanging back, almost like I'm still in high school.
Do you think this will come to bite you at some point?
Oh, yeah, definitely. My parents will still be there to help me along. They're not going to abandon me when I graduate. But once I start having to do things for myself, I know I'm going to fall on my face a few times. And that's probably one of the reasons I'm not looking forward to growing up, because everybody has to take those steps, and I'm just taking them so late that, you know, I might not get the sympathy I would get if I was 17 and trying to figure out student loans. I'm going to be 23, and I still don't have a concept of, you know, anything.
That was behavioral health reporter Mike and Scott speaking with Amanda, senior at Temple University. Well, I have to turn to you, Janet Burson, the clinician. I am sure lots of people listening had lots of reactions to Amanda. And I don't want to analyze her, per
okay.
se. It would be unfair. But I'm sure you've counseled a lot of Amandas.
I think that's happening with a lot of young people now, is the fear and the anxiety about going out there and functioning. First of all, they hear the job market's awful. They hear the economy's up and down, so that from outside they get a lot of sense of the uncertainty. I think a lot of young people don't have skills. And it's interesting that she mentioned the financial piece, because I certainly think that's true of a lot of kids whose parents have been very loving and very giving and maybe not help them learn how to manage money, or that there are limits on money, or what to expect when they're on their own and they have to be independent. Certainly, college does prolong adolescence, and for young people whose parents are able to send them to college and are able to foot a large part of the bill, makes it harder because they don't know how to do it. They may also have some kind of high-end tastes, which may be hard. I think the avoidance of responsibility and the from fear, not necessarily from irresponsibility, is true of a lot of young people. It is more comfortable up to a point to be back at home, and it is safer, and there's somebody taking care of you. And I think the dependence on parents, I mean, during adolescence, young people are often pushing away and fighting, and they want to be on their own, but they know they're not, and they're not going to have to function that way. So I think what she said was really very believable for a lot of young people.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Zach. Hi, Zach.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, thanks. What can we do for you?
Well, I was calling in. I am 30, and I'm about to have my first child. He's due in May. And, you know, looking back, it took me a while to get started. And, you know, throughout my 20s, while I was working, even though it was a steady job, I was in and out of my parents' house, moving into apartments with friends, back and forth. And throughout it all, my parents nurtured me the whole way, were not demanding, even though they wanted me to have some type of structure. And I think that our society as a whole is nurturing people farther along into their adulthood, and I think that might be the reason why we're seeing some of this. And, you know, going forward with my child, having been through that, it's interesting to think about how far forward we'll be nurturing him into his adulthood.
Well, wait a minute. You confused me about your parents here. Because it sounded like, if I read it right, like you were complaining about how protected you were.
I'm not complaining. I apologize for interrupting. I'm not complaining. I think that it helped me grow emotionally and into the adult I've become.
I'd like to ask something, though, about that, because I also heard it as being very nurturing. Do you think that their expectations of you were realistic, and that they put appropriate pressures on you as well as giving you appropriate support?
I think that they did as good a job as they could have done adapting the way that they had been raised to the way that I was being raised in my time. But they did have that older mindset of, you need to do this at this certain time. This is the appropriate measurement of where you should be at this point in your life. And while I may not have always lived up to that, if I didn't, they let me know that that was okay, because as long as you have the main goal in mind, that's the appropriate focus.
Larry, this speaks to something you addressed earlier.
Yeah, and I think that the challenge for us in this conversation is to try to figure out how much of the school of hard knocks approach to raising children is what young people need today versus the kind of protection that this caller has described. Because if it is the case that it is objectively more difficult to find a career, to establish economic independence, to start a family, and so on, if it is more difficult to do those things, then perhaps it isn't so bad for parents to provide a little more protection and a little more assistance than might have been the case in the past, because it's objectively more difficult to do.
Zach, thanks so much for your call. We've got to take a break. I want to ask Jennifer Lynn a question before we do. And that is, I hear the question in my office, if not every day, almost every day, is this normal? And right. I guess that's a parent's question always, every stage with their child. Is this normal? How do we find normal in this decade?
I mean, that's
you know, that's the $20,000 question right now. I think that we're getting closer to understanding what that is, and I think it's also valuable for parents to hear that just as they're experiencing this as a really new phenomenon and how kids transition to adulthood, you know, social scientists have only just recently started to empirically define what is normal. Well, what we do know is normal is that the age at which people are making transitions to marriage and parenthood are pushed back about 5 to 7 years. So about age 25, age 27 are the norms for transitioning to marriage and parenthood, respectively, in the United States. And we know that at mid-century in the 1950s and the 1960s, those transitions came earlier. So that part, we can say that it's more normative for people to make commitments to those roles a little bit later, toward their later 20s rather than their earlier 20s. What, if from a developmental perspective, as a developmentalist thinks about this question, what's not normal is when individuals are not progressing forward. So when you feel like an individual isn't moving toward adulthood, moving toward independence, that's, you can think of that as a non-normative experience. We know on average, almost all of 18 to 25-year-olds start to approach these markers of transitions we associate with adulthood near their late 20s. We do also know that it goes forward and backward, forward and backward.
Well,
a couple steps forward, a couple steps
backward. Of course, this question of moving towards adulthood really raises a whole lot more questions. I want to address them, but we've got to take a quick break, and I know, Larry, you had a comment about that, too. We're talking about prolonged adolescence. It's that decade from roughly the 20 until late 20, sometimes even 30. We are talking with Larry Steinberg. He's the author of You and Your Adolescent, The Essential Guide for Ages 10 to 25. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at Temple. Janet Burson is a psychologist in Morristown, New Jersey, and Jennifer Lynn Tanner is a visiting research assistant professor at the Institute for Health, Healthcare Policy, and Aging Research at Rutgers University. Well, we'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Abington Health supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new Orthopedic and Spine Institute, located at both Abington Memorial Hospital and Lansdale Hospital, offering minimally invasive procedures for joint and spine performed by board-certified surgeons. To access their online pain assessment and to learn if a specialist could help, abingtonhealth.org/bone or 215-481-BONE. That's abingtonhealth.org/bone or 215-481-BONE.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, and springtime is finally coming around the corner. So join us for a web chat Wednesday at noon at whyy.org/garden, and we'll answer all of your springtime growing questions. That's a web chat Wednesday at noon, only at whyy.org/garden.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about delayed adolescence or adulthood delayed with Larry Steinberg, Jennifer Lynn Tanner, and Janet Burson. Larry's well-known in this area. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at Temple. Jennifer Lynn Steinberg is a visiting research assistant professor at Rutgers. Janet is a psychologist practicing in Morristown, New Jersey. Let's go right to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll go to Christine.
Oh, hello. I'm glad to be on.
Well, me too.
Well, I respect your program, and my question is a little bit outside of your boundaries. I have living with me for the last 3 years, my now 40-year-old son, a perpetual adolescent in some ways. He's had, I kicked him out when he was 14 because of bullying problems, but he managed to get a GED and several jobs. But right now he's living rent-free, he gets his food, et cetera, but he's a bully. How do I get him out? I don't want him, you know, kicked out on the street because Bucks County has no centers for men.
Well, let me turn to the clinician. How's a mother to get her 40-year-old son out?
I guess one of my reactions would be kind of, what have you done so far? We worry a lot about the fragility of our children. And if you take a really strong stand, you're afraid, where are they going to go? What's going to happen? I mean, it's the concern about the shelters. But obviously, you can't live this way. This affects your life as well. And he's not learning to be a responsible, reasonable adult. This is the kind of thing you could go into to see a family therapist. And you might insist on it. It is your home. You are the parent. And you may say, look, we have to do this. The dilemma is, if he refuses, then what steps do you take? And I think that really is a bind. And maybe there's someone else he can live with, or someone else, if he's not able to live on his own, if he's not able to get a job or keep a job or act like a responsible adult, that may be a way to approach it. You need to be aware that it's your home. You do have some authority and power on it. It sounds like he's really missing some basic abilities in just terms of living life, and he needs to get them.
I agree. There does have to be, you do have to set minimum standards that are reasonable for him and for you. And, you know, I agree with Janet, ideally family therapy. If you've got questions about what kind of internal resources he has, does he have the ability to live on his own, then maybe the minimum acceptable standard could be to have him evaluated, you know, psychologically, and you know, let the psychologist come up with some recommendations and then have a family meeting to discuss how to do it. But something other than more of the same has to be done. I hope this feedback has been helpful for you. Just remember, anything other than what you've been doing is going to be more difficult. The easy way is to continue to do what you've been doing, even though it's uncomfortable. So I hope you're able to do something, and I do appreciate the call. I want to talk about the issue of parenting, and Jennifer, you said something when we spoke to you before the show. You said, how can I prepare my child for adulthood? And then you went on to say that parents were very confused, and that parents wonder, and this is almost a quote, should I put my child into every activity, or do I look at how play is important? So there's kind of a bias in that statement that you think that play is more important than structured activities.
I think I am as a developmental psychologist, yes. I mean, I think I can explain it this way, that good parenting is about process. So it's understanding that your child, regardless of his or her age, is really on a developmental trajectory. They're on a pathway. When they hit emerging adulthood, which is what I call the 18 to 29-year-old age period, it's a little bit of a different way of thinking about it, is to say that 18 to 29 is really its own life stage. It's not really extended adolescence, but it's its own unique life stage. So once they hit emerging adulthood, it's not as if they don't have a developmental history. So whether or not somebody is prepared, whether or not you're seeing exactly what you want to see between 18, you know, at 23, at 24, one has to think about what was going on before then. Because what we do know is that in adulthood, let's say age 30 or even midlife, the 40s, our empirical studies show us that it's both where a person starts emerging adulthood. So it's like where they enter at age 18, that matters, baseline, and also what happens to them during emerging adulthood. that has an impact and an influence on their health and their well-being across adulthood. They really kind of have to know what this baseline is. And when we talk about this issue about play, this is the tiger mom debate that's out there. Is it better to socialize and define your child's success and achievement by social indicators, which is a great GPA, graduating from a good school, getting a job with high prestige, getting married on time, having your first child in the expected way? Do we focus on those transitions that bring a lot of social reinforcement? Or when I talk about play, I'm saying, do we focus on developmental aspects of character?
And I'm sure, you know, as a developmental psychologist, yeah, I mean, you're answering your question. I think most clinicians would disagree, or certainly many. Janet?
I don't know that I would disagree. I think in terms of the question about activities and play, it's like everything else, you need a balance. Part of the dilemma for a lot of young people seems to be that they don't know what to do with themselves. They don't know how to make their own decisions. They don't know how to move forward, plan their lives, make things happen. And that may have to do with some of the early expectations as well as the current ones.
Larry, you've got a furrowed brow there, and yeah. I wanted to cite a piece of research that I read a couple of years ago that showed that this cohort around age 22, that they have more knowledge, but they are less resilient and that they're less flexible. And from the look on your face, it looked like you might disagree with that.
I guess I'm cautious about generalizing to, yeah, you know, the millions of people that are this age. There's an awful lot of variability. The kinds of challenges and circumstances we've been discussing, I think, are very much limited to the very affluent who can have parents, like the young woman Amanda from Temple we heard earlier in the show, who can have parents who can support them through and college and beyond, or Zach, the caller, who talked about how his parents helped protect him and nurture him until he was, you know, in his late 20s. There are many, many young people that don't have those resources. And I don't want to generalize about a whole generation of people. I do want to come back to something that Jennifer said before, and that's to say that I think that social scientists know a lot more about the timetable at which people are making these various role transitions into the labor force, out of school, into marriage, than we do about the psychological development of these young individuals. And whether you want to call it late adolescence, emerging adulthood, it doesn't matter. I think we can all agree that things are different now than they had been in the past. But what we don't know is whether the typical 23-year-old or 24-year-old today is psychologically any different than the typical 23-year-old or 24-year-old was a generation ago. We know that the circumstances of that person's life are likely to be different, but I haven't seen any good studies that compare people from different generations on common indicators of psychological development.
All right. We've got Janet now making a furrowed brow, and I'm making a furrowed brow, too, and my data is anecdotal, but go on.
Well, I don't know that there are differences within the organisms themselves, but I do think that the world presents something very different to these kids at this age. And I think for adults who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, did I get the right group? I think the way we've raised our children and way that group raises their children is in some ways different from the way people were raised before then, in terms of what they feel options are, as you were saying, what else is out there, the need to be independent, and maybe, again, what they want for themselves. And I think the part of who am I is a real big problem. I think kids don't know.
I would also add to this argument, we did a show last year on technology, and my guests had two categories. They called them digital natives and digital immigrants. And
people like us, older people, we're the immigrants. We weren't, but the digital natives grew up with technology. I've got a 2.5-year-old friend living at my house, and our biggest argument is he going to use my iPad? And he can use it as well as I can.
But Dan, look, when in the previous generation, parents and their children argued about whether the children could use the telephone. Is it, you know, I think that the few studies that have been done of how today's kids are using the social networking and the internet and so forth suggest that it looks much more like the way that previous generations of kids use the telephone than anything else. They use it to stay in touch with the people that are significant others in their lives. I'm not so sure that things are that different.
I hate arguing with researchers. They know the data. I hate that. Let's go to the phones. Do we have a call up? We've got Marty on line one.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Marty. How are you?
I can't complain, sir. I was calling. I'm a recent graduate. I'm 23 and I graduated from Westchester University, and my experience being in college were. Kids my age, or people my age, were very willing just to call their parents and ask for handouts. I wasn't really raised that way, and I feel that's the problem, that they want to go shopping, they call their parents, and say, can you send me $200? And they're just being spoon-fed, and that's what's causing people not to want to grow up and stay at home, because it's that easy to get what they want.
So the question is, and I'll turn to Jennifer Lynn Tanner, are parents nurturing their children into a state of fragility?
I think that it is, you know, bidirectional, meaning that often, you know, even the way that media introduces this topic, the burden of the issue falls on the emerging adult. Why won't they grow up? Why are they so unhappy becoming independent? Why are they refusing to grow up? But the parent preparing for adulthood and preparing for independence, as I was saying before, is a lifespan process. It really starts at birth with the relationship that you have and your preparation for independence, going off to school, going off to summer camp, preparing for the next stage of life. This happens over a long time before age 18. So, yes, I think that the roots of it are in the family, preparation for adulthood, and then I also think that it has something to do with parents' own development, the way they understand their role as a parent, and the emerging adult. But we can't completely put this all on the emerging adult. They didn't raise themselves, let's put it that way. And I think that, you know, there's some excellent parenting research out there that suggests that the real balance of healthy parenting is to both be warm but also structured and directing of development. And that should continue into emerging adulthood if you're willing to play that role as a parent. And then, but it's also very important before age 18. So I would say if you've been conditioned to believe you can call your parent at 21 and ask for $200 to go shopping, I'm not so sure that was the emerging adult's idea.
Hmm. Janet, why don't you weigh in on parents' role and responsibility, and then we'll take a short break. And then I want to talk about what can be done with children who are living at home.
Again, I think if you look at adolescence, even young adolescence, as part of a process moving a child towards adulthood and dependence, that has to do with responsibilities. It has to do with ability to manage money. It has to do with making decisions for yourself and judgment. And I think parents need to gradually let go and expect that. And the child may not always make the decisions that the parent wants. What I often hear with parents is, and talking about the telephone before, parents don't often know how to limit the children's exposure, partly because we're immigrants and because we don't have those same skills. So you hear parents often trying to set limits and have consequences, and the kids get around them because they know how and the adults don't. And I think that's a way that the technology has really come in. Mm. And I think in some ways parents are afraid of their children. We're afraid that if you don't give them stuff, they'll get it other ways. And so the idea of all the stuff and dangers that's out there, whether it's drugs or fraud of some kind or whatever, I think parents are worried that if they don't give to their children, something bad will happen and their child will be in trouble.
So as the level of anxiety increases, the level of trust in ourselves and in our children decreases.
And maybe the kind of limits we set for the children decrease.
Right, and that's all about parental anxiety. We've got to take a short break now. We're talking about adolescence delayed or adulthood delayed. We're talking with Jennifer Lynn Tanner, Janet Burson, and Larry Steinberg. Jennifer's a visiting research assistant professor at Rutgers. Larry's author of You and Your Adolescent, The Essential Guide for Ages 10 to 25, and he's a distinguished professor of psychology at Temple. Janet is a clinician, a psychologist practicing in Morristown, New Jersey. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Drexel University School of Public Health supports WHYY and hosts an information session Saturday, March 26th at 10:30 a.m. This is an opportunity to learn about the Executive Master's Program in Public Health aimed at working professionals looking to build their career. Drexel has the only fully accredited School of Public Health in Greater Philadelphia. For information, 1-800-2-DREXEL or publichealth.drexel.edu.
As tough economic times continue, many state officials are looking for budget cuts, and increasingly teachers are in their sights. In some parts of the country, thousands of teachers have been laid off, taken steep pay cuts, and lost their bargaining rights, even as standards for their performance are rising. We've talked about them. Now we talk to them. Guest host Farai Chidea is with us as she speaks with teachers from Ohio, Wisconsin, and California. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about delayed adolescence with Janet Burson, a clinical psychologist in Morristown, Jennifer Lynn Taylor, visiting assistant research professor at Rutgers, and Larry Steinberg. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at Temple University. You know, when we were on our short break, our engineer, Al Banks, said to me, quick question, Dan. He said, what's the difference between raising a child and raising an adult who's living at home? So, Larry, I'll turn to you since you're at eyeshot.
Okay.
Al's question.
Well, at any stage in the child's development, I think parents have to adapt their behavior to have developmentally appropriate expectations and rules. As Jennifer was saying before, there's a lot of research, a lot of it done in our lab here at Temple's, you know, indicating that the combination of warmth and strictness is what helps foster healthy development. So I think that combination needs to be there when your child is 2, and that combination needs to be there when your child is 22. But what the particular expectations are and how you express the warmth are going to change as your child becomes more mature.
So, Janet, let me turn to you. My 23-year-old is living at home. Do I have a right to set bedtimes? I mean, they're out until 3 o'clock in the morning and they're sleeping until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And it makes me crazy.
It's a real tough dilemma. And partly, you know, what often people say, if your 23-year-old was living somewhere else, you wouldn't know what time he went to bed or got up. I think part of it has to do with how much of a disruption there is in your home and what you expect that person to do. So that if he's got his music blaring till 3 in the morning, that you could set some limits on that. When we're talking about young adults coming home, I think my first reaction when we began to talk about this was because of the economy, it's hard to get jobs, kids can't get jobs, they're coming home, and it's an interim solution. when Larry and I were talking a little bit before the show, he raised the issue of what if a young adult is in the house and not looking for a job, and doing nothing but maybe being online and sleeping late.
All right. Hey, I'm the interviewer. I do the questions. You do the answers.
Okay.
So what if an adolescent is not looking for a job and hanging out online? So what's a mother to do, or a father?
I think you sit down with the young adult and you talk about what you expect and what you need them to do, and maybe you set some conditions so that if they don't do that, maybe they can't live there anymore. Or maybe, I mean, it needs to be an adult discussion, even if you don't think the young person's acting quite like an adult.
Larry, but I think that the key word there is discussion, because I think that this needs to be a conversation that you have with a young adult about what expectations are going to be and what the consequences for violating those expectations are going to be. And if the young adult is participating in the conversation from the beginning, he's going to be much more likely to go along with whatever you end up deciding.
Rather than laying down rules and roles.
Especially laying them down, you know, in the heat of an argument, you know, because you've been awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I've got a question. We've got a caller on the line, Erin, who's been very patient the whole show, and her observation is that this is more common in men than women. Larry?
It is more common in men than women. The data show that more men are moving back into their parents' home as young adults than women are.
May I add something?
Sure.
There's another issue that's involved. There's the developmental issue of whether or not somebody's progressing to meet developmental tasks. I think another issue that parents have on their hands, and something that's extremely important to talk about, is that between ages 18 and 29, we have a really high rate of mental health problems. In fact, mental health problems are higher in emerging adulthood than they are in adolescence or any other older age group. And the 12-month prevalence, or what that means is in any 1 year, how many people in our population, this is from a national population survey, meet criteria for a mental health disorder, the rate is over 43% in this age group. And we know that if you have a mental health problem, you're going to have, by definition, problems functioning, which means taking care of what you do, what you need to be doing at any given age. And so if parents do see some floundering and some stalling, and the interpretation is, well, I just can't help them move forward, if you're using discussion and you're really asking questions instead of giving answers to young people, and they're still not able to move ahead, I do think it's important that parents know that they really might be dealing with something that they're really not professionally trained to help with.
That's an excellent point. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Jerry on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Dan. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good.
I think it's a good show. I just, I don't want to say I disagree with you or your view, but I definitely agree with your female guest that these things are here to stay, and I agree with your male guest that you can't paint with a broad brush. And speaking from personal experience, I'm now out of my 20s and 30s, but I went through a lot of the stuff that the kids are today are going through, only I think they're actually doing it smarter than what I went through and how I reacted to a bad economic situation, which was move back with your parents right out of school, sacrifice your privacy, save your money, don't be a slacker if you live at home, but definitely don't just give your money to greedy landlords and go through that whole nonsense of traipsing around the country, living and putting your stuff in storage and wasting time and money just throwing it down a rat hole. It's better to go back. We're a country that was built on the extended family. So this whole concept of this so-called phenomena of people moving back into their family, it just shocks me when I look at behavioral scientists, because it's just common sense that would happen in a bad economy. Why is it so amazing to people that this is happening?
Well,
this is a normal state.
I think
we got away from the normal, and now we're going back to basics.
I think you make an excellent point, and I'm watching Larry Steinberg across from me, and He looks really happy listening to you, Larry.
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right, and I think that the tendency to kind of look at people in their 20s and blame them for this is not fair. And if you look at other countries, in Western Europe, it is not uncommon and not seen as abnormal at all for young people to live with their parents when they're in their early and mid-20s. And as Jerry, the last caller, has indicated that in many cases, that's the smart thing to do.
Yeah,
I think there's a dilemma, real quickly, and that is if you come back after college or whatever and you live with your parents, then what do you expect the rules to be? Because there's an impact on your parents and on their lives as well. And I think that is something that gets lost when we just talk about the kids. We don't talk about what the impact is on the family.
Yeah, that's a great point. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I apologize. Our phones are lit up. They have been lit up the whole show. We need more time, maybe another show on this. But thanks to all three of you so much. My guests have been Larry Steinberg, who's the author of You and Your Adolescent, The Essential Guide for Ages 10 to 25, Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Temple. Janet Burson is a psychologist in Morristown, New Jersey. Jennifer Lynn Tanner is a visiting research assistant professor at Rutgers University. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about body image and eating disorders in adulthood. If you've got a question, show idea, you can email us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. And you can listen to archive edition of our show on our website, whyy.org/voices, and we are podcast on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been the aforementioned questioner, Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern par excellence. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.